Hi, this is Mike Hunneke. Before we get into the podcast, we wanted to let you know that on Tuesday, May 13th, 2025, the Bureau of Industry and Security released three important guidance documents. All of these relate to the knowledge standard, including an awareness of high probability, and end use and end user catch-all provisions under the U.S. Export Administration regulations that turn on these definitions. You'll hear in the podcast that follows Brent and me speculate as to when and whether BIS and the Department of Commerce will lean into these concepts even more than they had already. We recorded that podcast on Thursday, May 8th in the evening. Obviously, this is a very relevant and important development. We've been convinced, if you've been following us for a long time or if you've been either voluntarily or involuntarily receiving our content and outreach over the last 2 years, we wanted to make sure that you were aware of this before you listen to the podcast. We will include links to everything you need to know in the show notes. I think it's fair to say we have thought more about the challenges that a high probability standard poses to companies and to trade compliance teams than I think anyone else, at least, that we're aware of. We've been on this topic for 2 years. Check out our blogs going back to August 2023 on our Fresh Looks landing page, and several articles that we'll link in the show notes as well, including an article I mentioned at the very end of the podcast, The Blind Men and the Elephant, from December of 2023, that to me was an articulation of really my philosophy and mindset on both the challenges of these standards, but also the opportunities that they present for trade compliance teams. You can now apply good judgment and defend that with a risk-based methodology. With that, here's the podcast. Welcome to Red Flags Rising. I am Mike Hunneke. I'm the co-chair of the Sanctions Export Controls and AML Practice at Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed. With me is my good friend Brent Carlson, a director at Berkeley Research Group. Brent, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. As always, great to be here and to be discussing very important topics with you.
Today is Thursday, May 8th. It is just about 7:30 p.m. U.S. Eastern. In this episode, we wanted to do a deep dive into end use and end user catch-all provisions under the U.S. Export Administration regulations. These catch-all provisions are known. It's not that they are completely unknown, but sometimes are overlooked or maybe deprioritized because people have to make very precise item classifications under the Commerce Control List. The end use and end user provisions are important because the government can rely on and leverage the many definitions, the full definition of knowledge, as we've talked about before, not only actual knowledge, but an awareness of a high probability. So Brent, where do we begin?
I think let's begin with the observation that there seems to be a continued fixation on export controls as being all about technical specifications. This is natural because we're talking about controlled technologies. When somebody starts dealing with this issue, you're going to be looking at the technology. What is it? Does it have an ECCN? As we see the enforcement field changing, and if we see the objectives of the Trump administration to make export controls simpler, stronger, and more effective, where the weaknesses lie are really in the end use and end user requirements, because all of those can trigger an export license application. So on the front end, it's looking at the technology, but looking from an enforcement risk perspective, it's really important to look at the end use and end user aspects.
I think there's probably a natural tendency as you're going through the end use provisions to focus on the word knowledge and attribute a common sense view to that or an everyday use of that term. You have to jump back around into different parts of the EAR to the definitions to see that knowledge, as we've written recently, is a multi-layered glass onion of different types of knowledge. The whole point of laws and regulations that have these alternative definitions of knowledge, or a more fulsome definition of knowledge, we should say, is that governments had experience with people getting away with things, where they could prove that they didn't have actual knowledge, where they could put their head in the sand. So what did governments do? Well, they responded. You know, some countries around the world take that less seriously, but many people for decades in our government have enacted many laws that are specifically designed very clearly to deal with that, especially in the white collar space where you're talking about regulation of economic activity, complex fraud, things like that. Well, Brent, taking your own caution, let's skip the technical part and just talk about these at a very practical level. Let's talk about a few real world examples that people listening might come across and talk through how the end use and end user catch-all provisions might have unexpected consequences.
All right, why don't we start with some hypotheticals? I'll play the role of somebody from a company coming to you with a question. And here we go. So, first question. I've designed my products to meet technical parameters so I can sell into, say, China in compliance with U.S. export controls. So can I say that I'm fully in compliance with U.S. export controls by only adjusting the technical parameters?
Brent, I think my ethical obligations require me to note that we're doing this on a podcast that hopefully will be heard by a lot of people. So there's no expectation of privacy. This is not a privileged attorney-client discussion that we're having right now. But generally speaking, Brent, what I would say is, well, that's part of the answer. But if you look at even within the Export Administration regulations, the Commerce Department publishes a flowchart, a decision tree of the different things you're supposed to look at. So don't forget to look at the other things, and don't forget to look at how those other things are defined. The other thing I think to keep in mind is that we've seen the government react, frankly, like any normal human being would, where they think they have set not only a clear line, but they've sent a message about the national security dangers that, in their mind, justify that line. Playing a game of cat and mouse with them or whack-a-mole is going to annoy them. And we've seen that. We've seen annoyance and frustration by some of the highest levels of government, cabinet secretaries, with what they perceive to be things that are too cute. Now, look, in total fairness to the companies trying to navigate these challenges, if the government really thought all of these things were clear and present dangers to national security, why did they let you manufacture and sell something that's slightly under those thresholds? One way to think about either how the government was thinking, which they might have been, or some people might have been, or about how the government might later, with hindsight, say it was thinking, they don't have to cover the waterfront on the technical specifications, because there's a inherent presumption in this that something that is under the technical specifications that can be shipped is not including things that would be for any of the prohibited end uses or any of the prohibited end users. It's not the case that the government thinks it has authorized semiconductors of a certain below threshold quality or performance to go to all customers in China. The government has authorized the export of those to China if it's not a military end user, depending on the classification for that particular one. If it's not a military intelligence end user or acting like someone who's in the intelligence community. If it's not involved in chemical or biological weapons. If it's not involved in ballistic missiles. If it's not involved in unmanned aerial vehicles. If there's not nuclear end uses. So in their mind, you're already talking about what may be pretty narrow, even if difficult to define in, you know, state-run economies or state-managed economies like that in China with civil-military fusion and things like that. So that's why I think it would be a mistake to attribute too much intent to the government just based on those technical thresholds.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about end user. I'm familiar with the entity list. And so, okay, I look at my customers. And again, this, I'm playing this hypothetical role. None of my customers appear on the entity list. So I'm clear to sell to them, right?
Think of the entity list, Brent, as a backstop. You know, if we know as a country, as government, that a certain end user, someone with a certain address, was engaged in violations of the export controls, or for whatever reason poses a national security threat. This is a list to prevent people from shipping to known bad actors. You can have a whole separate discussion about, are all of these people bad? Are there mistakes? Maybe they're not all bad. Maybe there's some mistakes on this. But as a default, it's just meant to say, well, for goodness sake, if we know something is a problem, let's just make sure no one ships to that. That's why there's no awareness or knowledge definition for shipments to people on the entity list. Government doesn't have to prove that. It's just a purely strict liability violation, as we've discussed about before. The entity list does have a notation that is, I think, overemphasized, that the presence of a company on the entity list does not automatically pull onto the list all of its affiliates and subsidiaries. Which for some of the large companies that do have parent or significant entities on this list, that could be hundreds of entities that get pulled in. Now, some of the nominees for important positions in the Department of Commerce have told Congress that they want to evaluate whether that rule should be changed so that it does apply automatically to affiliates and subsidiaries. If you think about the national security issues at stake, it is a bit odd to say, well, we trust this adversarial nation to strictly honor the corporate form and the fiction of legal structures and keep all the things we're worried about in this particular legal entity. I think it's very likely that people in adversarial countries just say, wait, so I just have to change the name. Now there's anti-evasion provisions. As we've talked about, the end-use provisions would apply even to an entity that's not on the entity list. So again, I think this is something where the government thinks it's casting a much wider net than some people might appreciate the entity list to be.
So I have a follow-on question on that. So you make a good point. What about this situation? I pose this again as a hypothetical. What if I have a customer that was not on the entity list, then it goes onto the entity list? So instead of shipping to that former customer, I ship to its subsidiaries. Are there potential risks there that I may run afoul?
Well, Brent, this is the factual scenario that prompted your very first Fresh Looks piece related to INSPER and its inclusion on the entity list, but not its subsidiaries. Although it was interesting to see, not that long ago, some INSPER subsidiaries were indeed added. A bit late, maybe, but were indeed added to the entity list. The addition of an entity to the entity list should trigger, in the best case scenario, a few different reactions or observations in your trade compliance team and your management. The first, obviously, is, okay, we have to stop shipments. And I know, and you know, Brent, from talking to people in industry, the superhuman efforts people have gone to when there's a Friday 5 p.m. addition to the list to stop shipments, to do exactly the right thing at great cost. If the government tells you, because they've now put somebody on the entity list, that there are national security concerns about that entity, you should assume that the government would consider that listing to not only be a red flag indicating a high probability of a violation of the EAR, the Export Administration regulations going forward, but they might also expect you to think critically about what did you know before that listing. Now, if you were the company or the exporter who saw something that didn't look right and you did the right thing and you raised your hand and it was your cooperation that caused the government to put the entity on the entity list, well, then you know why it's there. But if you weren't involved in providing the government the information that got the entity on the entity list, and really this applies to any of the other lists that could come into play as well, you should think about, well, how did it get there? Something happened. Some information came to the government somehow that suggested it needed to be listed, that there needed to be a license that likely wouldn't be granted before any shipments could go to that entity. It's a moment where it would be good and it would be prudent to look back at, well, what did we really know about this thing? And when did we know that? And to remember that it's not ever going to be just what did the trade compliance team know? What did the sales team know? What did customer support know? What did logistics know? What documents might the United States government have obtained from a cooperating government, from a due diligence investigative firm, from its own intelligence and military sources that would have prompted it to make that decision? If they start adding thousands of entities to the entity list at a time, I know sometimes they've added quite a few number at one time. I'm not suggesting that it's realistic for you to conduct an internal investigation every time there's a new entity on the entity list. But if you're shipping to entities that appear, you should take a look. Somebody told the government something that could cause the government to look around and say, well, who else was exporting to that party? Do I need to investigate why? And you may get just a friendly outreach visit. You may get a call. You may get BIS showing up, maybe they show up with the FBI. Beware, those things are not random, as we've talked about and written about before.
So from a compliance function perspective, let's say we do get a customer that does get onto the entity list, then what to look out for? Would that be the sales team then comes right away with same product, same specification, same quantity, but instead of going to the newly listed customer, it goes to a subsidiary or affiliate? Would that be, as a compliance officer, something that I should be really attuned to?
Totally. If something is too good to be true, it likely is. you should at least expect that there would be scrutiny. We've written and spoken about the concept and the value of the holistic approach and a dynamic approach to assessing your own risk. The idea being that trade risk, and really significant trade risk in our view, isn't necessarily driven by static moments in time where you can take a snapshot of what's happening and look at what you know at that moment. They're really driven by changes in time, especially around key events, exactly like somebody being added to the entity list or sanctions coming into place or a new enforcement regime coming into its own in the government and issuing guidance that might cause people to change behaviors.
Is there a legal basis for knowledge across the enterprise? What's the legal basis for knowledge where it may reside but may not be shared internally?
Well, Brent, that's called the collective knowledge doctrine and is one of the favorite doctrines of U.S. federal prosecutors in particular. They've had a long track record of being very successful in applying it. You even saw it in the recent August 2024 enforcement action that BIS announced, where they imposed a fine on a Pennsylvania company for selling ubiquitous catalog items, wires, very basic electronic items. You know, we've joked before about the paperclip could violate one of these provisions. Well, it's pretty close to that if you look at the fact pattern here. In that case, it revolved around the violation of the end-use provision related to UAV programs. What happened there, and what the company admitted to BIS was true, was that the trade compliance team didn't know this, but that the sales team knew this, that sales were going through a distributor, and that the sales team had distributors submit false documentation to the trade compliance team. The trade compliance team did their job. They looked at the information they had and authorized the shipment. But the government was able to attribute to them the knowledge of not just the trade compliance team, but also the sales team. This is the TE connectivity resolution from August 15th of 2024. This was the first ever resolution that really turned on and cited expressly to the high probability standard.
And that had to do with also sales into China as well, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Again, taking this hypothetical approach as a company saying, well, what if I don't make any direct sales? I sell through distributors. How is that going to lead to me being on the hook for having potential knowledge under the EAR?
It's a great question, and it's something people really struggle with. If you are sitting on top of a sales channel with 6, 7 or more tiers of various customers, distributors, resellers, and they don't even know who the customer is when they buy them from you, those are all things that are relevant to where and how you draw the lines here. The unfair challenge for exporters and manufacturers is that if there's something that goes wrong, the question from the government will be, why did you miss this? A potential response would be, well, we assessed the risk and we didn't think in this particular case for this particular product, this particular sales channel, that we needed to go all the way down. And we relied instead upon contractual provisions and certifications that we received and others agreed to at some point in that chain. So really the burden is on you to decide where you want to draw that line and then defend it. This is where doing an export control risk assessment that expressly takes into account the high probability standard is critical. If you're not thinking about that as part of the full definition of knowledge in designing your risk assessment, in analyzing the results of your risk assessment, and actually making those decisions about where your risks are, it's going to be really hard to explain later why you missed something, even if it's frankly completely unfair, even if it's 5 or 6 levels down. Think about where this is going to come up. This is going to come up where there's some kind of media disclosure or allegation, or worse, there's even some kind of battlefield recovery.
So in a sense, you're saying where there's smoke, there's fire, or potentially fire.
Well, Brent, that's certainly how the government's going to view it. To convince them that there's not fire, the burden is going to be on you to explain why you didn't think that there was a high probability of what happened at the time in a very difficult position where the thing has already happened.
Going back to those hypothetical questions that I had posed earlier, what about if, as a company, I say, well, related to these questions, I relied on the advice of a legal counsel. How does that work? Let's say I've got enforcement officials at my door and I say, look, I've done everything at the advice of legal counsel. Are there potential pitfalls with that?
Well, hopefully you're not getting that advice on the podcast, because as we said, that's not going to be any help to you. Look, why do people hire external consultants and advisors? It's to get good advice and help. Sometimes it's to be able to blame them later if they need to. Look, you and I both accept that that's part of our job, as service providers, broadly speaking, right? That goes along with the role. So where you have legal advice, it can get very tricky very fast. When you decide to say, hey, you know what, I was just doing what my lawyers either told me to do or told me not to worry about, by saying that, the government would be able to say to you, okay, great, you have just now relied on counsel. You've relied on counsel's advice, so that's a waiver. Let's see it. And it's not just the specific email. You don't get to just quote the sentence that you want to quote. Courts impose a subject matter waiver. What exactly is the subject is something that may vary a little bit, state by state, court by court, but it's going to be more than just the thing you want to disclose. It will also include, what facts did you tell those lawyers? And certainly your lawyers are going to want those facts to be in there. If you're wondering why sometimes legal opinions that you may receive from your lawyers are long, and they include, this is what the question was that you asked me, and they include, these are the facts that you provided me or that we found together, and here's the process that we went through to find those facts, and why there may be some really long footnotes at the front, this is because the lawyers are going to say, we gave you that advice based on this. Look, this is a big step. We're not advocating people do this in all cases or many cases or most cases. But if you get to that point where you feel that the government is telling you that what your advisors had told you previously was wrong, and you decide to do this, just be aware. If the advice you got wasn't from a lawyer in the first place, then I guess good news, there's no subject matter waiver, but the thing itself is not protected. You know, you could be ordered to provide that.
Very illuminating discussion. Let's say some of my most risky customers could be ones that don't appear on any list, on any restricted party list, given the catch-all provisions that we have in the export administration regulations. What should I be doing to protect my company, its officers and directors, and the legal and compliance teams?
This all goes back, Brent, to what we wrote about in another prior Fresh Looks piece regarding boards of directors and senior management. There were a series of decisions, I think it was early 2023, Brent, coming out of Delaware Chancery Court in litigation between McDonald's and its shareholders. Didn't relate to export controls, related to something else. But those decisions really articulated, and in a way somewhat reframed, at least how those obligations were previously understood. If you're at the board level, you want to make sure the company has an adequate system in place for preventing and detecting violations of law. You also want to be sure that management has in place a process that's appropriate for responding to red flags. This doesn't mean that you have to have internal police and that you have to read everyone's emails in real time or anything like that. It doesn't mean that the board can't rely on management to satisfy itself that these things are being done. Where something is a central compliance risk to the company, there are, though, slightly higher expectations under the duty of oversight. And this applies not only to directors, but also senior management. It's important that if something is a central compliance risk, that you're doing a little bit more than just taking someone's word that it's being done, especially if there's a change in mindset or a change in enforcement. The best thing a board can do, as the Commerce Department, really over the last year, since last summer, certainly through the July guidance, the August enforcement action that we mentioned, and really the Senate PSI majority staff report in December, has focused on this standard, this high probability standard that is directly applicable to the end use and end user provisions that we're talking about today, to ask, hey, how are we specifically addressing this new trend in our compliance program? Have it be an agenda item at a meeting. Have there be minutes, you don't have to be super detailed, but have there be minutes that there was at least an exchange on this? And if they say, well, we think we already cover it, have them tell you how so. Board should have a bit of constructive skepticism when they're being told that the compliance program is adequate.
An interesting comment on central compliance risks and how they may be changing. Could central compliance risks change in the world and in the environment that companies are doing business?
Of course, and this is why periodic risk assessments are so important and are an expectation of regulators. Now, it doesn't mean you have to do one every year. You know, some of these exercises, particularly if you're assessing really all enterprise risk, can take a huge amount of effort and time. Some companies do this every several years, every 3 years, for example, or it's prudent to do it if you go through a major divestiture or acquisition that changes kind of the mix of the business you're into.
You talked about a central compliance risk and how that triggers these obligations for officers and directors and the boards of directors under their duty of oversight for compliance programs. When I'm looking at risk assessments, do we need to be looking at not just one area, but other also potential areas and connecting the dots between recent guidance and other parts of the Export Administration regulations that could trigger potential exposure, like end use and end user provisions, combined with the full definition of knowledge, which includes an awareness of a high probability? Would that make that a central compliance risk, which would then, from a prudent perspective, we'd want to look at where are the risks that we're missing?
That's a challenging question, Brent. Look, I think that for any publicly traded company, I'm fully confident that they've disclosed that export controls are a risk, and that the regulations might change and that it could be subject to enforcement. Whether the U.S. government would look at the disclosures and raise questions about whether that risk was indeed being adequately disclosed to investors, that's really hard to say, and I think it would be case by case. If we start seeing what we think we will see soon, where you see a trend following this August 2024 settlement of BIS settlements either focused on the high probability part of the knowledge definition in the context of end user control violations, or settlements based on strict liability offenses like shipments to somebody on the entity list, but with the aggravating factor of it being also a knowing violation. We can call it another catch-all under the EAR that itself is a basis for fines and penalties. So it might be a bit creative, but you could see BIS combining those truly strict liability offenses with that knowledge add-on. The more that you see that happening, the more frequently that happens, and the higher the consequences financially for being caught by that, then I'd probably say, well, you could very well expect to see not only the government, but others in evaluating the sufficiency of compliance programs say, did we really cover off the end use and end user provisions? And not only did we cite to them, not only do we check to make sure that somebody's not, by the name of their company, a military company, or by their acknowledged shareholding in a military company, but did we look at what we were aware of a high probability of? Well, Brent, you've done a great job of managing me on this podcast by asking me lots of probing and I think more difficult than we had prepared for questions. Let's conclude with something that is receiving a lot of popular demand still to this day, or at least to this episode. Brent Carlson's Managing Up. Brent, when you look at the end use and the end user provisions and some of the challenges we've identified, and also how they may be a bit underappreciated, certainly in the types of awareness that could trigger them, what is your Managing Up segment for this episode?
This time, Mike, I'd like to pull from the wisdom of ancient India and the Upanishads, and specifically the Katha Upanishad. Here's the quote from that. Abiding in the midst of ignorance, thinking themselves wise and learned, fools go aimlessly hither and thither, like blind led by the blind. When I came across this quote, what triggered my mind was one of our original Fresh Looks piece, Know Thyself, or Know Yourself. The risk from a particular end user or end use depends upon your own company's particular perspectives and your relationship to them. So in navigating all this, remember, knowledge, quote unquote knowledge, under the Export Administration regulations is key.
Well said, Brent. It makes me think also of an earlier article, The Blind Men and the Elephant, where we discussed really this issue that some people were very publicly stating that they were cautious, curious, and skeptical that there would be any enforcement actions along these lines. Well, we've seen some, certainly not as much as been previewed, in total fairness to the people who were curious and skeptical, but we're still being told it's coming. I think that there's a lot of momentum towards more enforcement based on what the Secretary of Commerce has said, I think repeatedly, what his key lieutenants have said in their appointment process, really on both sides of the BIS house, on both administration and enforcement. So let's see what happens.
We hope for the best, but we need to prepare for what is coming, and the signals are clear.
Absolutely. Brent, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. As always, be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.